Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with Iran's almost theatrical retaliation against Israel's April 1st strike against its diplomatic compound in Damascus, which is clearly a limited tit-for-tat meant to placate Iran's hardliners while giving Israel and its allies plenty of warnings that the drones and missiles were on their way, contributing to the 99% success rate of shooting them down. Joining us is Nicholas Harris, the Senior Director for Strategy and Innovation at the New Lines Institute and the former Middle East Security Program Manager at the Institute for the Study of War. From 2016 to 2017, Nicholas served as the 10th First Lieutenant Andrew J. Basevich, Jr., USA Fellow at the Center for New American Security, and he is the author of From the Bottom Up, A Strategy for U.S. Military Support for Syria's Armed Opposition. And he's conducted an extensive study on Iran's proxies in the Middle East for the National Defense University. Then we'll look into the Senate Judiciary Committee's subpoena that finally is directed at Leonard Leo, the architect of the far-right takeover of the federal judiciary and the stacking of the Supreme Court to enact the moral authoritarianism and laissez-faire capitalist agenda of an extreme minority fueled by billions of dark money. Joining us is Lisa Graves, the executive director of the new corporate watchdog group True North Research. She has served as a senior advisor in all three branches of the federal government, as Deputy Assistant Attorney General in the Justice Department, as Chief Counsel for Nominations on the Senate Judiciary Committee, and as a Chief Deputy of the Article III Judges Division for the U.S. Courts. Then finally, we'll assess the records of achievements from the consecutive terms of Trump, then Biden, and speak with Paul Glastris, the editor-in-chief of the Washington Monthly, who spent 10 years as a correspondent and editor at the U.S. News & World Report. From September 1998 to January 2001, he was a special assistant and senior speechwriter to President Bill Clinton. He wrote over 200 speeches for the president on subjects ranging from education to healthcare to the budget, and he's a contributor to a new series at the Washington Monthly, Biden versus Trump, Who Got More Done? The Washington Monthly's Presidential Accomplishment Index. And before we begin, I would like to thank our listener donors who keep Background Briefing independent, corporate, and commercial free without paywalls or constant fundraising by making tax-deductible donations to our nonprofit foundation, the Public Truth Media Foundation, at publictruthmedia.org or at backgroundbriefing.org/donate. As we enter this fact-free and violence-prone election year, with much of the country under the cult-like spell of a deranged demagogue spewing constant lies while inciting hatred and violence, help us continue to seek out facts and information to awaken America's silent majority before our democracy is trumped by fascism. And joining us now is Nicholas Harris, who's the Senior Director for Strategy and Innovation at the New Lines Institute and the former Middle East Security Program Manager at the Institute for the Study of War. From 2016 to 2017, Nicholas served as the 10th First Lieutenant Andrew J. Basevich, Jr., USA Fellow at the Center for New American Security, and is the author From the Bottom Up, A Strategy for U.S. Military Support for Syria's Armed Opposition, and he has conducted an extensive study on Iran's proxies in the Middle East for the National Defense University. Welcome to Background Briefing, Nicholas Harris.
Thank you for having me, Ian.
Well, thanks for joining us, Nick. And as somebody that studies war, have you ever seen anything like this in terms of, there's an expression, the theater of war, meaning the battlefield and its surroundings. But in this case, the theater of war looks more like theater in the Broadway sense, that Iran went out of its way to say it was about to strike. It said when it launched its cruise missiles, giving Israel and its allies hours of heads up, and its mission at the United Nations after the strike was launched said, the matter can be deemed concluded. However, should the Israeli regime make another mistake, Iran's response will be considerably more severe. It is a conflict between Iran and the rogue Israeli regime from which the U.S. must stay away. So isn't this pretty clear that This is theater?
Well, Ian, I think you are framing this in the correct way. And it's something that I actually have reflected a lot upon over the last, let's say, 3 to 5 days, leading up to the Iranian waves of munitions that they fired at Israel. And you're right. There was a lot of drama, if you will, in the buildup to Iran's attack. You had the United States weighing in very forcefully, continuing President Biden's general theme of don't, the famous word now, don't, to Iran and to its proxies, such as Hezbollah. You saw very strong sort of backroom messaging from the U.S. to Israel, to Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, basically saying, we will help you fend off any attack, don't escalate. And you saw those same messages over the last 24 hours. What is interesting is that this new Middle East Air Defense Alliance, which is a Biden administration initiative, which really started in late 2021 and has really picked up steam, was successful. And what we have to look at here is this last incident that happened, in many ways, is more of a U.S.-Iran dialogue than it is actually a U.S. an Iran-Israel dialogue. Yes, the Israeli airstrike on the Iranian diplomatic asset in Damascus on April 1st is what initiated this sort of cycle of escalation. But in reality, this has been a U.S.-Iranian discussion point. And you saw very clearly that what President Biden wants out of this latest round of escalation is that Netanyahu can claim a win and that he curbs any type of escalation against Iran in response. And as you pointed out, when you look at the roughly 320 munitions, according to both Israeli and American estimates, that were fired mainly from Iran, they were slower moving attack drones, combat drones, some faster moving ballistic missiles. But in general, the munitions that were fired were meant to send a signal, as you put it, the drama, the theater of international relations. And what has been unsaid, actually, interestingly enough, sort of the coverage of this event, is that there's still, Iran still has an ability to apply strategic pressure on Israel via all the rocketed missiles, including precision-guided munitions that have been put on those rockets and missiles, as well as drones from Lebanon into Israel. And in fact, it's that asset and some of Iran's heavier, high-bar, medium-range missiles that are the biggest threat to Israel that weren't put into place. That says very clearly that from the Iranian point of view, this was all about sort of salvaging the honor of the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, a very powerful actor within the Iranian system. It's not about bringing Iran more fully into a regional conflict. And to your point, now it all depends on the decision-making of Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Is it enough for him to claim the win, to claim, you know, the figure 99% of these munitions have been shot down, most of them outside of Israel, most of them not by Israeli assets, but by American, French, British, Jordanian, and other assets? If that's enough for Netanyahu, that's the big question.
Indeed, it is the big question, and I don't know that we can really know one way or the other. Recently, Senator Tim Kaine, who was Hillary Clinton's running mate in 2016, said that Biden was played by Netanyahu early on after the October 7th Hamas attack on Israel, and that Biden knows he was played. And I don't know that Biden has a lot of influence, or anybody has a lot of influence over Netanyahu, because he, as long as he keeps the war in Gaza going, he stays in power and stays out of jail. So it's hard to know, but it's pretty clear that the signal out there, and on Sunday today, of course, the UN Security Council is meeting, and Biden is organizing a G7 conference as well. So, as you mentioned, of the 170 drones and the 30 cruise missiles and the more than 120 ballistic missiles, all of whom apparently were fired by the Revolutionary Guard Corps. 99% were shot down. Biden's told Netanyahu, you know, to just to take this as a win and not retaliate. So do you think the other shoe's going to drop? Do you think there's enough pressure from the international community and from Biden? And as you point out, the Iranians haven't really pulled the trigger, the main trigger they have in terms of retaliation, which is Lebanon and Hezbollah.
Well, this is a really important framing, Ian, and I think it's great that you're framing it in this way, because fundamentally what we have to understand is that the main source of this conflict at the moment, yes, there are decades of longer standing, escalating conflict between Iran and Israel, but the focal point of this current escalation is, in fact, still the ongoing war in Gaza. And that much of what is happening in the broader region, from the Iran and its Hezbollah network, including its forces in Lebanon, the Hezbollah network in Lebanon and in Iraq, the fact that the Houthis, which are more of, let's say, a partner than a proxy of the IRGC, have entered that broader conflict by putting pressure on shipping in the Red Sea, the fact that you have sort of this, the broader element of Russia and China, if you've noticed, Russia and China have been very much on Iran's side in terms of their messaging. And even the messaging that came out of the last 24 hours, Russia and China have used language emphasizing de-escalation. By the way, so has Saudi Arabia, interestingly enough. And I think there is a sort of subtle interplay here between sort of Russia and China's growing support for Iran, in the case of Russia militarily and diplomatically, in the case of China more broadly, as China wants essentially Russia and Europe, Iran and the Middle East to put pressure on the United States, to weaken the United States globally, which allows China to be more aggressive in Asia. Okay, so broadly speaking, geopolitically speaking, the fact that you have China and Russia issuing statements for all intents and purposes that support Iran, the fact that you have Saudi Arabia being very cautious in its messaging, although we can surmise that the Saudis, through the intelligence means at least, may have been part of the operational planning for the defense of Israel through the Middle East Air Defense Alliance, that, yes, fundamentally speaking here, the broader geopolitics are putting really pressure on Benjamin Netanyahu. And the question is this. Netanyahu has made it very clear that he sees the current war on Gaza as a long-term conflict. And now, of course, Israeli commentators who either oppose Netanyahu or who may be sympathetic to Netanyahu but are extremely disappointed with the Israeli security establishment's sort of response, both in the buildup to October 7, 2023, Hamas attacks in Israel, but also in the aftermath, all are sort of wondering the central question, which is, does Netanyahu need sort of a never-ending conflict in the Middle East to stay in power? And if that's the case, then there's going to be far greater pressure on the U.S.-Israeli relationship, because fundamentally, the U.S. strategic perspective is the Middle East needs to go quiet so the U.S. can focus on Russia in Europe and China in Asia. And that none of those things, Ian, have changed. What has changed is this, is that the Biden administration supports Israel, does not support Netanyahu, but is handcuffed essentially to Netanyahu's decision-making. If Netanyahu decides to press the lever on that train, the Biden administration is going to be flying in the direction towards a larger conflict in the region.
And Netanyahu knows that, and Biden knows that. So it's a very delicate moment. And you can't help feeling how outrageous it is that all of the Western assets, and particularly the U.S., in stopping this rain of missiles, and apparently just a couple of the ballistic missiles got through to an Israeli airbase where they have the F-35s that struck the Iranian consulate in Damascus, just southeast of Beersheba. Apparently they did hit that target, although they didn't do any real damage. They also apparently hit an Israeli intelligence center close to the Syrian border, but by and large, Israel was largely protected by its allies. So if Israel goes ahead and provokes a wider war with Iran, are the allies stuck? Do they have to come to Israel's defense, even though the last thing that Biden wants is a war in the Middle East, as you pointed out? Biden wants to help Ukraine, and all these anti-missile assets that were used to protect Israel should be protecting Ukraine, because Ukraine's getting slammed by Russian ballistic missiles and knocking out its electrical grid and killing civilians. And then they just fired a whole bunch of double-tap missiles after hitting a bunch of civilian targets, killing Ukrainian civilians. They then fired more to kill the Ukrainian first responders. So it's a hideous situation when you contrast it with how much we're protecting Israel and how we're failing to protect Ukraine.
Well, so it's interesting, too, when you talk about the Middle East, you know, this Middle East Air Defense Alliance, the fact that the United States, I think, has spent billions, at least $4 billion in terms of underwriting Israel's air defense systems. Israel has advanced air defense systems for pretty much all types of munitions, ranging from drones to mortar to drones to rockets to missiles. It has these sort of interlocking defense systems, which are highly dependent now on sensors, intelligence gathering capabilities that are in the Gulf, are in the central region of the Middle East. We saw how important Jordan's role was in the air defense of Israel over the last 24 hours. So fundamentally, you know, Ian, we take a step back. This is a U.S. regional defense system in place that happens to also apply to the protection of U.S. military assets in the broader region. And, you know, a lot of the news coverage is going to focus on how successful this defense system was. And it was quite successful. As you pointed out, Nevatim Air Base in southern Israel, where you have those advanced F-35s, are based out of was sort of this a symbolic target. Some of those munitions got through. You also had Hezbollah fire volleys of missile rocket fire in the Golan as well. But fundamentally, the point here, too, is that, yes, geopolitically, the United States is on the back rope and is on the back foot, if you will, is on the back foot in Europe. Yes, you have an expanding NATO. Yes, you have greater European, you know, slowly but surely greater European assistance for Ukraine. But just the fundamental math of the war in Ukraine is that the Russians have far more capabilities to win a war of attrition than Ukraine does. And at a time politically in the United States where both Israeli and Ukrainian security assistance are being tied up in internal U.S. politics in terms of spending bills, the fact that, just more broadly speaking, the image of the United States has taken a major hit over the course of the war in Gaza, especially in the so-called third world, we have a number of rising powers in the world, regional powers, rising economies, rising population centers, that kind of support the Russian and Chinese narrative on the U.S. being a hypocritical actor in global affairs and that shouldn't lecture other nations. That image has just increased because of perceptions of sort of U.S. support for Ukraine, but U.S. lack of support for the Palestinians, especially civilians at Gaza, in support of Israel. So in that context, it's been tough. And then another thing to keep in mind is from the military context, because we started the conversation from that point of view. The way that Iran has developed its attack capabilities through these various types of airborne munitions, such as that it has that so-called ring of fire that former IRGC Quds Force Commander Qasem Soleimani developed, which is you have from southern Lebanon, the 3Gs, southern Lebanon, the Galilee, the Golan in Syria, and then Gaza, different sort of vector points in which to put a ring of fire, as the IRGC called it, around Israel. That's with a near conflict. The IRGC is actively trying to build networks of support inside the West Bank among disaffected Palestinian Arab militant fighters. And the Israelis, through their internal security forces, have been seizing increasing numbers of small arms and explosives that Iran is trying to get into the West Bank to cause an insurgency there. So that's the ring of fire. That's the inner rim. And then, of course, there's the wider rim of fire, which includes the Houthis, which includes Iran itself, which includes assets in Iraq, etc. And fundamentally, what we saw play out over the last 24 hours is one of those vectors, but not the most powerful vector from which Iran can apply pressure on Israel. We can imagine, and in fact, it's not very difficult to imagine, that in an actual all-out regional war, Lebanese Hezbollah would be involved, Iraqi Shia militias would be involved, the Houthis would be involved, heavier and perhaps more advanced munitions from Iran would be involved. The war in the Gulf would escalate, potentially leading to the destruction of U.S. and allied military assets in the Gulf. So that's actually the nightmare scenario here. What we saw over the last 24 hours was in some ways Iran testing the ability of the U.S. and its allies essentially to support and protect Israel. So I expect that in the coming days, it's already happened. We know, we can tell it's already happened. But in the coming days, weeks, and months, both sides, the U.S. and its partners and allies, and Iran and its partners, will begin to assess, okay, what does the next round of conflict look like? And from the Iranian point of view, although their attacks mainly failed, they learned a lot about the type of responses and the types of intelligence gathering the U.S. and its allies have. And I suspect that if this were to escalate further, in fact, U.S. regional partners in the Gulf and probably Jordan itself would actually be targeted as a way to undermine the broader regional defense system.
Well, Nicholas Harris, I thank you very much for joining us here today. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Ian. Always a pleasure to chat with you.
Well, thank you, Nick. And again, I've been speaking with Nicholas Harris, who's the Senior Director for Strategy and Innovation at the New Lines Institute and the former Middle East Security Program Manager at the Institute for the Study of War. From 2016 to 2017, Nicholas served as the 10th First Lieutenant Andrew J. Bacevich Jr., USA Fellow at the Center for New American Security, and is the author of From the Bottom Up, A Strategy for U.S. Military Support for Syria's Armed Opposition. And he's conducted an extensive study on Iran's proxies in the Middle East, for the National Defense University. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into the Senate Judiciary Committee subpoena that finally is directed at Leonard Leo, the architect of the far-right takeover of the federal judiciary and the stacking of the Supreme Court.
Come, you masters of war. Here that build the big guns. Here that build the death planes. Here that build all the bombs. Here that hide behind walls. Here that hide behind disks.
I just don't want. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Lisa Graves, the executive director of the new corporate watchdog group True North Research. She has served as a senior advisor in all three branches of the federal government, as deputy assistant attorney general in the Justice Department, as chief counsel for nominations on the Senate Judiciary Committee, and as a deputy chief of the Article III Judges Division for the U.S. Courts. Welcome to Background Briefing, Lisa Graves.
Thank you so much for having me on, Ian.
Well, thanks for joining us. And finally, Leonard Leo, this powerful figure that operates in the shadows and has corralled at least $1.6 billion, more likely $2 billion, to spend on right-wing causes and to re-elect Trump and MAGA Republicans. He's already essentially stacked the Supreme Court, not just with the three Trump appointees, but earlier ones as well. He's had an unbelievably outsized influence over American life, and he's come from an extremely minority sect of zealous right-wing Catholicism known as Opus Dei, and yet he is able to essentially impose a kind of moral authoritarianism on the nation, which has resulted in the Dobbs decision. As much as that can be blamed on Trump, it could also be blamed on Leonard Leo. But finally, at least, he's being subpoenaed to come out of the shadows where he operates with this couple of billion dollars of dark money. But on the other hand, he's spurning the subpoena, right? So is he ever going to testify?
Well, that's right. He is continuing to refuse to cooperate, continuing to refuse to comply with a lawful subpoena. And he is someone who has the audacity to have created and fueled groups that use the name Rule of Law Defense, when in fact he has been one of the key figures in dismantling the rule of law, dismantling the legal precedents that Americans rely upon to protect their freedoms, and really acting opposite of the rule of law. In his zeal to reverse the precedents of the 20th century that gave meaning to a language in our Constitution, equal protection of the law, and more. And so he continues to be defiant. We'll see what happens next in terms of enforcing this subpoena. But I certainly appreciate Chairman Durbin, Richard Durbin of Illinois, and the members of that Senate Judiciary Committee, including Senator Sheldon Whitehouse and others who voted for that subpoena. And I appreciate the chairman issuing that subpoena to Leonard Leo, because the public has a right to know how he has used his wealth, the wealth that he has deployed from billionaires like Barry Side, but also the wealth that he's accumulated since he started a for-profit business a few years ago that derives a lot of its revenue from the nonprofits that he sends money to. People have a right to know how this man has influenced the Supreme Court, how he's been involved in arranging trips for Supreme Court justices, in particular Clarence Thomas, and arranging secretly for pay of six-figure sums or more to Clarence Thomas's wife, Jenny Thomas.
Well, he is, of course, struck out at Sheldon Whitehouse. Leonard Leo said, "I'm not capitulating to this, to his lawless support," talking about Dick Durbin. I'm not capitulating to his lawless support of Senator Sheldon Whitehouse and the left's dark money effort to silence and cancel political opposition. So he's using the Trump tactic of turning accusations against him onto his opponents.
Well, as you point out, this is it's irony. It's ironic, I suppose, although not in the traditional literary sense, but in the popular sense. And he thinks he's being silenced. Actually, what's happening is a request for him to not be silent, to share the reality of how much money he has directed into the coffers to pad the luxury lifestyle of Clarence Thomas and Jenny Thomas. The public has a right to know when someone has been secretly funding the wife of a sitting Supreme Court justice, who the sources of those funds are, the funds that are secretly paying or have secretly paid Jenny Thomas. People have a right to know when someone is giving gifts or arranging luxury travel for a sitting Supreme Court justice. And he's not being silenced at all. He's being asked to open his mouth and reveal the truth. The truth that he desperately, desperately wants to hide through all these tactics to try to evade accountability and lawful legal process and the rightful and just inquiries of the U.S. Senate Judiciary Committee.
And meanwhile, of course, he has enriched himself through all the billions that he's managed to get from right-wing donors, particularly Barry Said, the $1.6 billion that he got from him. He bought himself a $3.3 million summer home in Mount Desert, Maine, and then he bought himself another home in Mount Desert, Maine for $1.65 million. He bought four new cars, private tuition for his children, hundreds of thousands of dollars donated to Catholic causes, and he has a wine locker at Morton Steakhouse. So he seems to be benefiting personally from all of this, but I suppose if you've got a couple of billion dollars to play with, a little of that will trickle down, right?
Well, there's sort of two phases of it that are worth underscoring. So the first phase is after he is picking the list of judges to go on the Supreme Court that Donald Trump chose from in order to destroy Roe versus Wade and other precedents or, coming for gay rights and more. But as Leonard Leo was then the vice president of the Federal Society, a group of right-wing lawyers that's really designed as a pipeline to power, to screen them for office so that they advance this extreme agenda. Leonard Leo was the vice president of the Federal Society at the time that Kavanaugh was nominated to the U.S. Supreme Court. And that summer, Leonard Leo paid off his 30-year mortgage 22 years early for his home in Washington. Where did that money come from? We don't know. It seems not likely to have come from his Federal Society salary at the time. He'd been paying on that mortgage for years. Suddenly, he was seemingly flush. And then, literally on the eve of the vote to confirm Brett Kavanaugh to the U.S. Supreme Court, the day that the cloture was invoked to force that vote to happen, Leonard Leo closed on that $3.2 million mansion in Maine with $1 million cash down and a more than $2 million mortgage. Then he stayed at the Federal Society. So where did that $1 million come from for that mansion in Maine, that robber baron era mansion in Maine? Who was paying him? Where was that money being funneled through? Because he was not an employee of the White House, the White House counsel's office, he was not required to file financial disclosure forms for how he was becoming so seemingly enriched while he was playing this key role in basically helping to force Brett Kavanaugh onto the U.S. Supreme Court. Then in the spring of 2019, Bob O'Hara and Sean Boberg published a story about Leonard Leo. That story disclosed that fact that in the previous year, while Brett Kavanaugh's nomination was pending after Justice Kennedy resigned, Leonard Leo had this seeming expansion in fortune. But what happened after that was that summer in 2019, while Leonard Leo was still acting as a vice president of the Federal Society, he paid off that $2 million mortgage for that mansion in Maine in cash. Where did that $2 million come from? Who was paying him basically for his role in packing the U.S. Supreme Court and the courts below the Supreme Court? Then in 2020, he left the Federal Society as his day job. He continued to be the co-chair of its board, and he launched a for-profit enterprise, the CRC Advisors that you mentioned, Ian. And then he bought this second mansion in Maine, the one that was cost more than $1.5 million. He also bought a church in Maine nearby. And as you point out, he bought cars, he paid for his kids' tuition and more. And as he was operating that for-profit entity, that for-profit entity was benefiting from many of the nonprofits that were being funded by the new money that Leonard Leo secretly had access to, we didn't know about for about 2 years, from billionaire Barry Side, who gave him that $1.6 billion trust fund in order to shape and basically regress the law in America. And through that fund, Leonard Leo pays himself about $400,000 a year for about 25 hours a week. So he's become a very rich man. He's been rewarded for this effort to destroy our freedoms. And he has been absolutely defiant about complying with the lawful and legitimate requests of the Senate Judiciary Committee. And of the Attorney General in D.C., Brian Schwab.
Right, who's wants to look into his use of his charitable vehicles that he has, right?
Yes.
But when you say he's defiant, the few times he's ever gone public, and not really public, but people have been able to record him at various private right-wing events, he's completely out there in terms of his zealotry. I mean, he really believes that people like Sheldon Whitehouse and people who criticize him or try to smoke him out and shed some light on what he's up to, working for the devil. He says that. I mean, he really is quite Manichaean, isn't he, in his outlook?
Yeah, he is Manichaean, that's exactly right, and it is so extreme. He said that, he believes that the people who are against him are basically tools of the devil. He has called progressives the progressive Ku Klux Klan. He has tried to describe himself as a warrior against so-called barbarians. His language is extreme. That's from a speech he gave to the Catholic Information Center when he received their highest award. But there are other speeches that he's given where, for instance, behind closed doors at the Council on National Policy at CNP, where he talked about this was after Brett Kavanaugh was confirmed and they had, five of the nine seats on the U.S. Supreme Court. He said that we stand at the precipice of what he called the revival of this thing that he's described as the so-called structural constitution. And he told the people in that room that which included people, up to in their 70s and 80s, that no one in that room had seen the kind of revolution that this court was about to undertake. Basically to roll back people's rights before the New Deal. And then he has given a couple of interviews in the last year to right-wing press where he has reiterated this very extreme view where he, attacks anyone who wants to advance progressive ideas as woke, in which he vilifies his opponents. in which he, you know, talked about how he's trying to influence broader society to create sort of mini versions of the Federal Society to create these pipelines of power for people who agree with him. And he's deploying his money to do so. But he's also been targeting the state levers of power. We have a new report coming out that talks about how he has targeted state Supreme Court, state attorney general positions, state governor positions, state treasurer positions through these various vehicles that he operates. And he has become, through one or two of his groups, one of the biggest donors to ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council. So he literally is trying to capture the levers of power at both in the federal government and the state government. And he, in my opinion, has extraordinarily extreme and regressive views. And he has not been held accountable for the way he has used that wealth and directed that wealth in order to keep someone on the Supreme Court who never should have been confirmed in the first place and whose corruption should get him impeached someday, I hope. Clarence Thomas, if he had any ethics, would resign, but he does not. And we're going to have to impeach him at the earliest possible opportunity, in my opinion.
So, Lisa Graves, just in the last couple of minutes, though, there's been some reporting lately about how Biden is raising a lot more money than Trump, even though Trump had a bunch of billionaires down at Mar-a-Lago recently. The money that Biden is raising pales compared to the $2 billion that Leonard Leo has to deploy in this election for far right-wing causes and MAGA Republicans. So isn't that the real story? This guy, he's already bought the Supreme Court. Can't he buy the legislative branch and possibly the executive branch?
Well, it is the case that through this Barbell Freedom Trust, which initially began with $1.6 billion and now has about $1.2 billion, over the past 3 years that we know of, not including this year, he's spent about $200 million a year pushing money into these nonprofit groups, many of which are actively engaged in what they call, you know, public education, but includes efforts to try to move the courts, you know, in one direction or another. So, for example, Leo has been the biggest donor through his groups, particularly through the Judicial Crisis Network Concord Fund, into the Republican State Leadership Committee, which then plays a key role in trying to determine who gets on the state Supreme Court. And he has a number of other vehicles that he's pushed money through. And he also has used a number of conduits to hide where that money is going. He can't use that trust money to directly run an ad saying vote for or against a candidate. But he has deployed that money in a lot of ways that are designed to influence, the outcomes of those elections. And so, as you point out, he has at his disposal, in essence, a $1.2 billion trust. I suspect when we finally get the reporting from the public disclosures from spending in 2024, which we won't see until later in 2025, because it's not required to be disclosed, we'll see hundreds of millions of dollars being spent by Leonard Leo on undisclosed vehicles with the purpose, I'm sure, in part, of trying to swing this election toward a more regressive set of people and issues.
So just in closing, though, Lisa, now that he's defying the subpoena from the Senate Judiciary Committee, and by the way, they didn't subpoena Harlan Crowe, the Nazi-loving billionaire buddy of Clarence Thomas's and Leonard Leo's, how are they going to get this guy to go public? I mean, to face questions in the light of day?
Well, they're going to have to get that subpoena enforced in a court of law or hold him in contempt. Congress does have contempt power, but I also do hope that they issue that subpoena to Harlan Crowe, because Harlan Crowe has records of his gift to Clarence Thomas that are beyond the records that Leonard Leo has of his own role in keeping Clarence Thomas on the Supreme Court and helping to keep him in the lifestyle to which he thinks that he's entitled to. Harlan Crowe, as your listeners know, is the one who has fueled Clarence Thomas's trips on private yachts, foreign trips and trips on his private jet to his private resort up in upstate New York. And Harlan Crowe also, like Leo, has a deeply regressive agenda. And as you point out, and has been reported, he, you know, has a penchant for buying Nazi memorabilia, even having had it on display at his house. He also has a statue garden of dictators. Harlan Crowe is someone who has a vast fortune at his disposal, and he has deployed that fortune to help keep Clarence Thomas on the Supreme Court, in my opinion. And he's also, his political agenda has been aligned with the decisions of Clarence Thomas. And so I think we have to talk about corruption in a common sense way. It's not like you're bribing someone to vote differently than they would. It's that this culture of money has kept a sure vote on the court in order to try to regress our law, repress our freedoms, and move America backward. And Harlan Crow has been instrumental in that effort by the way that he has helped keep Clarence Thomas in this luxury lifestyle, along with some other billionaires like Charles Koch and more.
Well, Lisa Graves, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thanks, Ian. Thank you for having me on.
And again, I've been speaking with Lisa Graves, who's the executive director of the new corporate watchdog group True North Research. She has served as a senior advisor in all three branches of the federal government, as deputy assistant attorney general in the Justice Department, as chief counsel for nominations on the Senate Judiciary Committee, and as a deputy chief of the Article III Judges Division for the U.S. courts. We're going to take a brief station break and back with an assessment of the records of achievements from the consecutive terms of Trump, then Biden. This is the part. You can't got mag zappy dippy dippy dope, but the whole damn nation got the same. Honey, only fly to the B, the support, not the president with government lane. Put me on a slow moving parliamentary hacking bandwagon. You can put me little ass in the grave. Every time you want it, I'll be live, bring a date. I mean computer when it's over, press save. So you can be the president. I'd rather be the Pope. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Paul Glastras, the editor-in-chief of the Washington Monthly, who spent 10 years as a correspondent and editor at U.S. News and World Report. From September of 1998 to January of 2001, he was a special assistant and senior speechwriter to President Bill Clinton, where he wrote over 200 speeches for the president on subjects ranging from education to healthcare and the budget. He's a contributor to a new investigative series at the Washington Monthly, Trump versus Biden, Who Got More Done? The Washington Monthly's Presidential Accomplishment Index. Welcome to Background Briefing, Paul Glastras.
Great to be here, Ian. Thanks for having me.
Well, thanks for joining us. And I want to talk to you about the work that you're doing at the Washington Monthly, which involves a lot of people, many of whom I've talked to recently, by the way. Jacob Harbin and Caroline Fredrickson, just had her on a couple of days ago, as a matter of fact. So, but is this upcoming election at its essence, Paul, about reality and unreality? Because if you watch what happened on Friday down at Mar-a-Lago with the new Speaker of the House, Mike Johnson, standing next to Trump, announcing an election integrity project or program or policy, whatever you want to call it, that's completely based on unreality. It goes back to Trump's 2016 election, where he lost the popular vote for 3 million by 3 million and then said that there were 3 million or 5 million invisible Mexicans who voted. And that's why he lost to Hillary by 3 million. And so we're back there. And the undocumented don't vote. The border is not open. Democrats are not letting immigrants flood into the country to immediately vote Democratic. None of this is real.
Well, you know, it's easy to conclude that Americans, you know, these days don't care much about reality, right? The economy gets better. Joe Biden's job approval numbers go down. You know, Donald Trump's legal losses pile up and his grip on the Republican Party tightens. So I hear you. You know, Ben Shapiro, the conservative pundit, famously wrote, "Facts don't care about your feelings." But for a lot of voters, something like the opposite is true. Their feelings don't care about the facts. But I don't think that's true of all voters. And it certainly isn't true of our readers or your listeners, right? There is a segment of the country that really does care about the records of these two presidents and is really focused on the facts and the policies. And it's for them that we wrote this, devoted the entire issue of the current Washington Monthly to the a detailed accounting of Donald Trump's and Joe Biden's presidential records of accomplishment. And we did that on 146 separate policies across 21 policy areas, fact-checked, very reliable, and you know, you can see the results right there at our website.
And you've got it broken up with legislation, foreign policy, that was Jacob Harbin, the courts, Caroline Fredrickson, trade, regulation, work and family, antitrust, immigration, healthcare, and veterans. And the categories are diplomacy, trade, healthcare and public health, immigration, infrastructure, manufacturing, energy and environment, labor and employment, antitrust, regulation, taxation, education, courts, crime, social welfare, social issues, state and local aid, veterans, guns, cannabis.
Yeah, so. Yeah, we kind of covered the waterfront. And you know, yeah. We didn't like rate their accomplishments based on what you, Ian Masters, you know, would have wanted them to do, or I, Paul Glastris, or my editors would have wanted them to do. We rated them based on what the administrations themselves said were their accomplishments and said they wanted to accomplish. And, you know, we just went through those lists and that those documents, and we tossed out the dubious ones or the small ones. And then we researched and described them in a factual manner, with context, and so that this is a document that from now to the election, anybody can turn to, a journalist, you know, a campaign, any, you know, enlightened citizen who wants to know the facts can turn to it and say, yep, this is how the two presidents compare on all of these area policy areas. And, you know, is that gonna, you know, we are under no illusion that most voters are going to, you know, make careful decisions in November based on thoughtful assessments of the candidates' records. But we think it's still worthwhile for several reasons. First of all, most voters are not going to determine this election. This election is going to be determined, as your listeners know, by voters in a handful of swing states, and among a very narrow demographic of key voting groups, young people, you know, white, rural, working class people, you know, minorities, and which messages are going to work best on which voters months from now is still something we don't know. And so it's not unreasonable to suspect that by the fall, some aspects of the voters' governing records could wind up being decisive. And then there's another reason to do this, and that is, this is the first time in over 100 years where we have two presidents from the major parties who served back to back running against each other. Hasn't happened since 1882. And so you can do a fair one-to-one comparison. And, you know, you can really sort of say, how did Donald Trump do on infrastructure? Well, the fact is Donald Trump got $8 billion worth of infrastructure funding. It wasn't zero. It was $8 billion, which is not nothing. Joe Biden, he got $1.2 trillion, right? That's a fair comparison. Both of them said that they were going to deliver a big infrastructure bill. One delivered a tiny one. The other delivered a monstrous one. And so on down 21 categories.
So if we're going back to 1892, when Democrat Grover Cleveland challenged and defeated Republican Benjamin Harris, is that what you're suggesting? That
yeah.
Biden can win? I mean, the way that I see it, Paul, is that this country's being held hostage to the tortured ego of a very sick man who cannot accept defeat and will not accept defeat, and has created these fantasies about his own record. He says he was the greatest president ever, with the greatest accomplishments, even though, as your study has pointed out, there's very little he can point to. I recall, and I'm sure you remember it as well, when he stood before the United Nations in his first term, and he basically told the world body, the leaders of all around the world, that I'm the greatest president in American history, and they laughed at him. I mean, so do you think that the ammunition that you're providing here could be weaponized by the White House to, rather than accept the unreality of him standing there with the speaker down in Mar-a-Lago talking about a non-existent problem which they're going to solve, and all of this other stuff that we, you know, about his great accomplishments? Can they be aggressive and say, you know, use what you've provided them with as a weapon to say, no, this guy's a complete failure, and look at the contrast? I mean, in other words, I guess I'm talking about the weaponization of the facts that you provided as opposed to the facts themselves.
Well, I'm not sure I would use the word weaponization, but, you know, fair enough, right? Politics is war by other means, and facts, whether they're true or false, can be used as weapons. Look, either candidate can use the information we have. Of the 21 categories we mentioned, Donald Trump won three of them. Courts, he had three Supreme Court justice picks to Joe Biden's one, for instance. Taxes, his tax cuts bill, which cut primarily corporate rates, was a bigger deal than Joe Biden's tax initiatives, which were impressive, right? He created the family tax credit, child care tax credit, but it only lasted a year. So Trump, you know, edged him out on that. And there are other categories where the two kind of tied, right? We think on immigration, Trump made it, you know, used cruelty to stop people at the border, and that was a political loser for him. And Joe Biden, you know, took a more gentle approach, and he's getting killed politically on it. So, you know, neither of them has been any more or less successful on that. But on 16 other areas, I think it is 16 or 12, or, you know, certainly the vast majority, Joe Biden did more, got more done than Donald Trump. And I would hope that the candidate that has the best facts, which in this case would be Joe Biden, would use this material, which of course they know. They didn't need us to tell them that, but, you know, most people don't know that. And most campaigns don't know that. And most, you know, the kind of voters who listen to your program, who are the kind of people their friends and family listen to because they're informed, right? They can be informed themselves with these facts. And I do think as the campaign progresses, the issues will matter more and more, simply because the candidates and their ads will focus on their accomplishments more and more. And the press will focus on what the candidates talk about. And if we have debates, which is not a sure thing, but it's certainly a possibility, they're going to be all about the candidates talking about their accomplishments. And you're probably going to want a document that separates the bragging from the truth. And this is it. So I do think there's a chance that this document can be of value and have a role, maybe an important one in what happens in November. I hope so. That's why we did it. So we spent 3 months, you know, doing almost nothing but this. It was quite a lot of work, and I hope your readers will give it a look.
Well, is it though, to boil it down, Paul, is it about competence versus incompetence? I mean, I've tried to talk to as many of the people that actually work with Trump and were inside the Oval Office with him, people like Miles Taylor, who I just interviewed a couple of days ago. And when you hear from the people who actually worked with this guy up close and personal and saw what an amazingly incompetent, ignorant, reckless, sadistic man he is. It's shocking, and you wish that the public knew that because again, he portrays himself as the greatest president ever, but when those who actually witnessed him at work were just appalled and alarmed, and we know that next time around, the adults in the room aren't going to be there. So, do you accept the notion that the contest could be argued in terms of competence versus incompetence, and that maybe the best ammunition the Democrats have are Trump's former inner circle, the adults in the room?
You know, it's interesting. I don't know another president who has more people who worked for him at very high levels, having written so many books attacking him and given so many interviews attacking him. I can't think of one book yet by anybody who worked for Joe Biden who's done that, for instance. So I think you're right. And look, competence is in the eye of the beholder. And 40% of the country doesn't believe and is never going to believe that Donald Trump is incompetent, right? That's a given. But, competence as measured by accomplishment is different than the abstract of competence, right? So Bill Scheer, our political editor, has a story in this issue on the comparing Donald Trump and Joe Biden on their legislative records. And Joe Biden crushes Donald Trump in terms of the number and importance of the major legislation he signed. And why is that? Well, Joe Biden is famously a veteran lawmaker who was extremely patient in working with members of the opposite party, or recalcitrant members in his own party. Donald Trump, never having served in public life, and something of a hothead, was famously unable to get along with Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer. And he could not cut bipartisan deals and therefore didn't get very much done. Again, who got the infrastructure bill done? They both said they were going to do it. One got it done and the other didn't. And that is competence. And I don't know how better to illustrate the difference than that.
But isn't there a fundamental difference between Democrats and Republicans, in as much as Democrats do feel that government itself is important? And, going back to Ronald Reagan's mantra that the government is the problem itself, and the Republicans seem to be entirely about, one, just thwarting any Democratic agenda to stop them, or two, put up, in terms of what they're offering, show trials and culture war red meat thrown to the base. So is this about a kind of fundamental difference between sort of social democracy and grandstanding?
I think there's something to what you say, right? Democrats as a party are defined by what makes Democrats who might not share the same opinion on, say, the police or immigration or whatever, what unifies them as Democrats is the belief that government has an important role to play in solving problems. And it's not that Republicans don't think that way too, but they also have a much deeper belief that government is more problem than solution, as you said. And so it affects their records of accomplishment. If you don't come to Washington in order to get things done, but instead you attempt to keep the Democrats from getting things done, then you'll probably in general get less done. But it gets back to competence also. So let's look at the issue of regulation. We have a whole story on this. Donald Trump, you wouldn't judge Donald Trump based on how many regulations he got passed, right? He's a Republican. Republicans generally believe that regulation is a deadweight loss in the economy, and they're against it. And sure enough, Donald Trump came to office promising to cut red tape and get rid of regulations. Joe Biden, on the other hand, is not anti-regulatory. In fact, you would measure Joe Biden by the vigor with which he used regulation to advance his agenda. So how did each do based on how you would judge them differently? Well, regulations actually went up under Donald Trump, not by much, but they did. But here's the key statistic. When Donald Trump's efforts to deregulate went to court, got taken to court, because that's pretty typical, 77.5% of his regulatory actions in court failed. The average for all presidents is 30%. So as a deregulator, he was not very successful. Whereas, you know, Joe Biden was reasonably successful as a regulator, using regulations to advance his agenda. So there you go. It is a difference in the ideology, but it also translates into a difference in competence and ultimately achievement.
Well, Paul Glastis, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Paul Glastis, who's the editor-in-chief of the Washington Monthly, who spent 10 years as a correspondent and editor at the U.S. News & World Report. And from September 1998 to January 2001, he was a special assistant and senior speechwriter to President Bill Clinton, where he wrote over 200 speeches for the president on subjects ranging from education to healthcare to the budget. And he's a contributor to a new investigative series at the Washington Monthly, Trump versus Biden, Who Got More Done?, the Washington Monthly's Presidential Accomplishments Index. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and assistant producer Evan Green to help us sustain this program into the future and ensure it remains free to all. Please take a moment to support us by going to backgroundbriefing.org/donate or publictruthmedia.org, where you will find our nonprofit Public Truth Media Foundation, where your tax-deductible donations, large and small, keep us broadcasting. And if you've missed any of today's programs or would like to explore our vast archives, you can find us at backgroundbriefing.org, where we include extended interviews searchable by topic and have made it easy for you to sign up for daily email updates that provide links to resources, articles, and books discussed on the program. Also, you can find links there to subscribe wherever you get your podcast, and we encourage your ratings and reviews on these platforms. Find us on Twitter and Facebook at Ian Masters Media, and please do help us reach more listeners by sharing this program with friends, family, and colleagues. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. The guy that lived next door in 305.